Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine the state of labor in America with a labor organizer and educator and an historian of American labor. First, we will speak with Les Leopold, who directs the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute and is a strategic consultant to the Blue-Green Alliance, which brings together trade unions and environmental organizations like the Sierra Club and the United Steelworkers Union. Then, to get a sense of where the labor movement stands today in comparison to its strength and percentage of the workforce that was unionized in previous decades, we will speak with Leon Fink, who edits the journal Labor, Studies in Working Class History of the Americas. We will discuss what might revive the labor movement and restore the American dream as the current recession deepens and jobs, or the lack of them, become grist for the political mill in the upcoming election year. I'm speaking with Jonathan Alter, who's an analyst with NBC News and a Bloomberg View columnist. He's the author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and The Triumph of Hope, Between the Lines, A View Inside American Politics, People and Culture, and The Promise, President Obama, Year One. He has an article at Bloomberg View, America's Lost Decade. Thank you for joining us on Background Briefing, Jonathan Alter.
My pleasure.
And the article uses the fresco in the ceiling of the U.S. Rotunda, which we often see in low angles when they interview politicians inside the U.S. Capitol, and the extent to which fully one-third of the ceiling is devoted to scientists and inventors like Franklin and Samuel Morse. And the point that you make in your article, The Last Decade, is that we are now faced with a possibility of a presidential, we certainly have a presidential candidate, but even a possible, and he's leading in the Republican presidential field, a possible president who is anti-science. And I'm curious as to why the United States, given its global hegemony, has so much to do with science and invention, why it would abdicate that kind of hegemony so blithely.
Well, I don't think we have abdicated it yet, but what's happened is that one of our political countries in the United States is in the grip of a radical fringe that has become hostile to science across a broad front. And then we have independents and some Democrats who find various things that they might be unhappy about with President Obama and just pocket or otherwise don't credit the things that he's done to advance science and the environment and other rational things, which in some cases people don't know about, or in other cases they are of such a purist frame of mind that they don't recognize just how much worse a Republican president, particularly Governor Perry of Texas, would be on these kinds of issues. So you get... When there's a Republican president, Republicans close rank behind him. Even when Ronald Reagan raised taxes, which of course is anathema to conservatives, they didn't whine and act like crybabies about him. But you can't really necessarily say the same thing about Democrats. So that's weakened President Obama and put us into a position where he's vulnerable. Obviously, the backdrop to all that is the terrible economy and the 9% unemployment.
But Jonathan Alter, is there a kind of creeping theocracy here? Because there's so much of the core support now for the Republican Party, and there's no question that Governor Perry began his campaign by having a religious revival meeting in Houston. Now, clearly, a big part of the message to the faithful gathered there was, I am not a Mormon. However, you can't escape the connection between the religious right and Governor Perry.
No, you can't at all. I mean, other presidents have kind of used the religious right, and that includes President Reagan, the first President Bush, and especially George W. Bush. And while I don't want to denigrate the degree of their religious faith, they mostly were using the religious right as a political instrument. In Perry's case, he believes all this stuff, and he's very much with them, not just politically, but in his heart. It's very obvious from his comments over the years. I spoke recently to somebody who traveled with him to the Middle East, and was their takeaway from the trip was that he was a religious zealot. So this is the kind of thing that again, there will be certain people who will vote for him because they want this kind of America, but there aren't enough of them to elect Perry. So the only way Perry gets elected is if somehow independents and Democrats get so hornswoggled, so bamboozled by whomever, that they cannot see their own self-interest and the interests of the country in remaining a non-sectarian society clearly. So the stakes are very high. And, you know, when I hear on your broadcast or on other broadcasts a lot of whining about President Obama, it's not put in the context that it needs to be, which is that this is not about President Obama. It's about a choice between President Obama and something that would be not just a little bit worse, but infinitely worse for this country. And so I hope, you know, in the 14 months between now and the election, less than 14 months, that when progressives get together, talk on the radio, on television, it is done in this context. These are the stakes. The stakes are that we will no longer be you know, on the leading edge of scientific and medical research, and that we will have a flight from reason toward narrow faith. And that's a lot more than, you know, you don't like this decision or that decision by President Obama.
But Jonathan Aldrin, it is not a strong argument, and it's unfortunately an all too frequent one, that you have to vote for your guy even if you're disappointed in him, because the Supreme Court could go radical right or whatever. It's usually the specter of something terrible rather than, you know, an inspiring narrative. And it's clear that the right has a narrative, but it's not very clear that the Democrats have a narrative.
Well, I think you're right about that. And in my earlier book, The Promise, I was critical of the president for not having more of a narrative, for not having a better communication strategy. I liked this recent speech that he gave on jobs, but I thought it was at least a year and a half, maybe even 2 years later than it should have been. So you can say all of these things, but this is, you know, politics is always the art of the possible. And as the president himself says, you don't want to make the perfect or even the very good the enemy of the acceptable, and the failure to imagine you know, what life would be like if we essentially repeal the New Deal, which is what's at stake here, if we have we're one vote away from having a radical Supreme Court, radical right Supreme Court, and, you know, all the other things that, well beyond a Supreme Court, that a president who is ideological and hostile to the achievements of progressivism over the last 100 years, the consequences of that so dwarf any possible disappointment, in some cases, I believe, a misplaced disappointment in this president, that it almost boggles the mind. And so, you know, I basically, I hate to sound harsh about this, but my message to progressives, and this will be my message to them to the extent that anybody cares about what I have to say, but over the next year, is grow up. You know, we're talking about politics here. We're not talking about some platonic ideal of what government should be. Now, did everybody have, including me, everybody have unrealistic expectations about what Barack Obama could deliver if we elected him president? Did he misplay his hand at various points? Yes. But even the details of that are much more complicated than most people assume. And, you know, I found in the extensive interviews that I did for The Promise that a lot of these things, like, oh, the stimulus should have been bigger, very easy to say, but at the time it simply wasn't possible, you know. And so there are complications here that a lot of progressives miss when they're assessing these events.
Can I speak with Jonathan Aldrin? He's an analyst for NBC News and a Bloomberg View columnist. His latest book is The Promise, President Obama 1 Year Later. He has an article at Bloomberg View, America's Lost Decade. But as much as you're concerned about Perry, Jonathan Alter, surely the more frightening prospect for President Obama's re-election chances is Mitt Romney getting the nomination.
Yes, that's true. that's true. Romney would be harder to beat than Perry, but we also don't know where the economy is going to be next year, and the indications are not very positive. So it shouldn't be. The idea of a Perry presidency is still quite possible, and he's not to be underestimated as a shrewd politician.
Well, this gets to this puzzlement that I have, and I wonder if there's a sort of Stockholm syndrome, a political version of the Stockholm syndrome here. What explains the fact that you had the euphoria of 2008, and a tremendous number of people voted, 140 million voted. 2 years later, in 2010, about 80 million or so voted, a huge drop-off, and all of the Republicans voted, and a lot of disappointed Democrats didn't vote. Now, that is more likely to happen again in 2012, that same phenomenon.
So, no, I don't think so. Barack Obama was not on the ballot. Young people traditionally don't vote in midterm elections. The elderly vote in much greater numbers. And the Republicans ran a campaign that was not noticed by a lot of pundits, but that basically was accusing Obama of hurting Medicare because there are some responsible Medicare cuts that were in subsidies to the wealthy that were eliminated by the Obama health care law. And so they used that, the Republicans used that, to really drum up a lot of support from the elderly, who already had been, they were the only group that supported McCain. So they voted much heavier numbers. They're more dutiful. And we might not be seeing, and Hispanics traditionally don't vote much in midterm elections, and they stayed true to form on this. So drop-off between presidential and midterm was not exceptionally high, but it by historical standards. But it still, as you said, was from about 130 million to about 80 million. And so I would actually view that as something that's encouraging for the Democrats, assuming that the base doesn't act in a immature way and decide that it will sit on its hands and give the country to the radical right. You know, we've seen this movie before. In 2000, there were a number of progressives who either stayed home or they voted for Ralph Nader, and we know what happened that year. And in 1968, some of your older listeners, you know, may recall that there were supporters of Gene McCarthy who had qualms about Hubert Humphrey because he'd been a supporter of the Vietnam War until toward the end of the campaign. They didn't like him very much, and so they sat on their hands, and we got Richard Nixon and all the things that followed that. So,
Also, you can add to that 1980 when Jimmy Carter was challenged in the primary by on the left by Teddy Kennedy, and then in the general by a phony Republican, John Anderson,
right,
and that helped elect Reagan. So we know that there are suicidal tendencies,
right,
on the part of the progressive left. But
I
was curious, though, about on the right, why, and in the center, which is what Obama's after, why they would be attracted. And my only explanation is a kind of Stockholm syndrome thing where, you know, why would people vote for a party that wants to destroy Medicare, destroy Social Security, and is telling you that you can't have health care, that something's wrong with that. Every other civilized country has it. It's just, a lot of it doesn't make sense. It's a kind of...
I don't agree with you on that. I think it does make sense because you know, if Obama is elected with 9% unemployment, reelected, it would be the first time since 1936 that a president has been reelected in the face of that kind of headwind. Franklin Roosevelt was reelected in 1936 when unemployment was about 14%, but it was down from 25%. So, you know, this is a very tough road just because of the economic condition of the country. And a lot of people who don't vote in off your elections, or many of those who do, they have busy lives. They're not listening to this program or reading, you know, my columns or even watching cable TV, which has a total viewership that's less than one-tenth of the electorate. And they're just going about their lives, and all they know is that they don't have a job, or their brother or cousin doesn't have a job. They will be inclined to at least take a hard look at somebody who can promise them that there might be better times ahead. Now, there are some things that are problematic for Romney, which are just now starting to get attention, and this is where the Republican primaries can be helpful to Obama. Romney, when he was governor of Massachusetts, Massachusetts was 47th out of 50th in job creation. So when he turns to the president, if Romney's the nominee in a debate, and said, you didn't create jobs and I will, the president has a pretty good rejoinder. Well, you had your chance as governor of Massachusetts and you failed. You know, so they both failed in that term, in those mm-hmm. terms. And Perry has had a good jobs record in Texas, presided over job growth in Texas, but their unemployment rate is now moving up pretty quickly and is now at 8.5%, not that far from the national unemployment rate. So, you know, these are basically, if it becomes a referendum on President Obama, up or down, he loses. If it becomes a choice, he's much more likely to win. And so, in saying that, I think it's incumbent on anybody who does not want to have a radical right future to put their analysis of the president, whether they're analyzing his Middle East policy, analyzing his record on the environment, his record on jobs, in a comparative context. And that's not done nearly enough.
Well, Jonathan Alter, though, we haven't really talked about your article, America's Lost Decade, but in that context, you know, my sense is that anger, confusion, and cynicism may be a stronger emotion in this upcoming political year than reasoned disappointment. And will the American people listen and learn from the simple lesson that you're putting out in this article, The Lost Decade? You point out that since we've just observed the 9/11 attacks 10 years later, what has happened in that 10 years? And it's all disastrous compared to what happened in the 10 years since Pearl Harbor, which is often compared to 9/11. You know, the nation accomplished an extraordinary amount between 1941 and 1951. The GI Bill, the creation of the United Nations, the crushing of fascism around the world, etc. And look what has happened in the 10 years since 9/11. It is so dismal, with 46.2 Americans now living in poverty. Wages haven't risen. We have to take our shoes off at the airport, etc. Is that simple historical lesson going to resonate?
Well, I think it might to a certain extent. Not only were the aughts, the last 10 years, I call them the aughts because that's what they were called 100 years ago, and also it ought to have been different. You know, not only was it worse than the 1990s, it was worse than any decade in the last 100 years in terms of moving this country forward on the domestic side, and it certainly wasn't successful internationally either. But, in terms of what we built, like even during the Depression when nobody had any money, we were building a lot of the infrastructure that we use now. Of course, we built the interstate highway system in the 1950s and in the 60s, civil rights and a lot more. And I kind of take the reader through these decades and just briefly through the last 10 decades. It's a relatively short column. And then try to explain how unfavorably the last 10 years have compared. We basically got nothing done, and in terms of advancing the United States, and other than some good work internationally on AIDS, it's really hard to come up with things that were done, that were accomplished by this country in the last 10 years. Now it's true we weren't attacked a second time on George W. Bush's watch, and that's what he'll be pointing to, I'm sure, in his presidential library. But other than that, he stacks up so poorly on the record, just the record of accomplishment or lack thereof, compared to previous decades, even the 1970s, which are considered to be a horrible decade. A lot of important things happened in society. Some of this goes beyond a president. You know, so in the 1970s, we moved toward gender equality, we moved toward environmental protection, and did some other important things. But we just did not move ahead and arguably moved behind in the last 10 years, and that heightens the stakes in this election even more. You know, we can do better, and once we get past some of these economic problems, we're not going to get back to where we were in terms of the bubble economy, mm-hmm. but we can do better, and that's why this infrastructure debate that's going on right now is so important. Mm-hmm.
Well, just in closing, though, the amazing thing is that it's sort of it reminds me of that Naomi Klein book, The Shock Doctrine, is, and how the people who've destroyed the economy or set us back a whole decade are you know, using that as a weapon, and they're using it successfully. I mean, they're the ones that the Republicans, particularly Bush, caused this deficit that now the Republicans hold up as this reason why we have to impoverish ourselves.
That's right. The year 2003 was arguably the most profligate in American history. I mean, you have a $1 trillion war. You have close to a $1 trillion prescription drug benefit that's unpaid for. And of course, you have $1 trillion in tax cuts that are tilted toward the wealthy. So, you know, that's more than $3 trillion, a lot of money. And you're absolutely right. And so they now turn around and want everybody to forget that it was on their watch that this happened. And because of the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, the Koch brothers and their ilk now can spend at will. And so there's a question of whether the same people who got us into this mess might now kind of hijack democracy and put somebody pliable in there. Now certain progressives will say, well, Barack Obama was pliable. Well, to a certain extent he was, and I'm critical of him on that, but you know, there are also things he got done, the credit card bill, and there are things in Dodd-Frank that haven't gotten very much attention that are pretty good. So, you know, it's just time for people to recognize the stakes, stop complaining about their own disappointments, and move toward, using the next election to build a stronger progressive movement, which in the last 3 years hasn't happened. The energy has been on the right. Now, it's easy to blame Obama for that and say, well, you know, he didn't spread his magic dust, but it wasn't really up to him. You know, he said during the campaign, we are the people we've been waiting for. And it's true that he didn't ask enough of that movement. He didn't mobilize it properly. But ultimately, it's the fault of progressives collectively themselves. And the first way to get back toward pursuing, advancing a progressive agenda is to make damn sure that Obama's the president over the next 4 years.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jonathan Alter.
Thanks so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Alter, who's an analyst for NBC News and Bloomberg View. He's a columnist with Bloomberg View. He's the author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days, and The Triumph of Hope, Between the Lines of View Inside American Politics, People and Culture, and his latest book, The Promise, President Obama, Year One. He also has an article at Bloomberg View, America's Lost Decade. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the possibility of the euro really crashing.
Because after all, he's just a man. Something warm to come to when nights are cold and lonely.
detective down in Texas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. Currently, he's a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007. And he's the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
Thank you.
And you're just back from Switzerland, where you've been meeting with a group of bankers. Meeting of European finance ministers attended by U.S. Secretary of Treasury Tim Geithner ended inconclusively and unsuccessfully. And it feels to me like, just as here in this country, we have this peculiar drift where economic realities and political possibilities are completely at loggerheads. It seems in Europe the same problem. The economic realities are not being dealt with in terms of political possibilities.
Yes, I met with a large number of regulators as well. And in Europe, the cover-up of bank losses is even more severe than the cover-up of bank losses in the United States. And so it's pretend and extend is the phrase.
So is this the irony, therefore, Bill Black, that the German people are angry and they don't want to bail out Greece? German Chancellor Angela Merkel has rejected the idea of floating Eurobonds, which was one of the suggestions from George Soros. But my understanding is that the irony here is that what they're really bailing out are the German banks.
Yeah, they're certainly bailing out the European banks. And within that category, by far the worst banks are the German banks. I call it German banks gone wild. As soon as they got outside of the confines of Germany, they went absolutely nuts. And so if you look at all of the crisis countries in Europe, the German banks are the worst of the lenders.
You mean they're most exposed? And why is it, therefore, that they blame the borrower and not the lender?
Because the lender are important parts of their political coalition, so they don't blame their coalition except perhaps behind closed doors. No, the leading beneficiary of the bailouts is the German banks, and therefore, in the end of the day, Merkel, despite losing virtually every state election, has continued to do these bailouts. And, of course, what is happening in economic substance is that it's all of the EU members who are bailing out the German banks. So there's actually a flow of capital to Germany. But if you ask the typical German in the street, they'd probably think it was the opposite.
Well, isn't that the problem, Bill Black, that the German people feel that there's a choice in this matter and the politicians haven't leveled with them? If they don't give the Greeks this extra $8 billion that's been promised, the whole Eurozone could unravel, and that would throw us back into a recession and possibly a global depression.
Well, I'm not sure that that part is true, that it would necessarily put us into recession. Indeed, the attempt to keep the euro, the currency, in place is one of the greatest dangers of causing the next recession, because the periphery is having forced upon it in a time period when they're in severe recessions, austerity measures, which are the worst possible policy approach. And as a result, of course, the recessions have gotten worse. Unemployment has grown enormously. Unemployment in Spain is at roughly 20%, and in southern Spain, Andalusia, it's 30%. So these are Great Depression levels.
Sure, and you have to add to that what the austerity has done in England, self-imposed. It's totally marooned their economy. And the austerity that was agreed to in the economic hostage crisis here is also putting our economy into free fall. But surely, though, a collapse of the euro would add to this already pretty tenuous situation.
I don't think so. I mean, it would certainly be a serious issue for Greece, but whatever Greece does, the results are going to be bad.
Mm-hmm.
There are no good choices here available. And right now, as I said, we are completely pretending. So the so-called stress tests, which are a joke worldwide, are a particular joke in Europe because they exclude sovereign debt exposure. Well, you know, that's the principal risk mm-hmm. that they face. So you take a stress test that involves not stressing.
Right. Well, isn't that the problem that's happened since Lehman Brothers, is that private debt is now being transferred into sovereign debt, and the U.S. have shown the way, and that, you know, seems to be the what they're trying to do nowadays, and it's absolutely catastrophic for the taxpayer.
Well, no, it's actually far worse. They're not equivalent. The United States still has a sovereign currency, and things are very different. Individual European nations that are members of the euro do not. So when you're in a serious recession, there are three remedies that you can try to use. They're not mutually exclusive. You can try doing a combination of them. One is to devalue your currency. Well, you can't do that because you're a member of the euro. Two, you can have an easier monetary policy. Well, you can't do that because the European Central Bank runs monetary policy, and that means the Germans and the French run monetary policy, and they run it in the way they like it, which is a pretty austerity-filled way, and they could care less that it causes disaster in the periphery. And the third thing you could do is to have fiscal stimulus, but you're not allowed to do that under the EU rules, under the woefully misnamed Growth and Stability Pact, which really causes contraction and instability. You're not allowed to run a significant deficit in a recession. In other words, you're not allowed to have automatic stabilizers that are really successful. So instead, you get these insane policies that are, in jargon, pro-cyclical, which simply means they make the recession worse. And that's just the economic insanity. None of the governments that sign on to these austerity pledges will survive. Each of them will be defeated. And that's already happened in Iceland and Ireland and Portugal. And so you're going to get tremendous political instability, and that's in the periphery. In the non-periphery, you get the rise of these ultra-right-wing parties, including one that's in coalition, in power, in Finland. And the EU rules in general require unanimity in votes. So we now have the insanity of this minority, extreme ultra-right Finnish party making EU policy, or at least blocking EU policy in terms of trying to deal with any of the problems of the periphery. And so Finland's right-wing sub-subgroup is, in essence, holding hostage any effort at recovery. And we don't as many forms of insanity as we have in the United States, and God knows we have them in abundance, Europe has all of those plus these extras problems.
Again, I'm speaking with William K. Black, an expert on bank fraud. He was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention and the author of the bestseller, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. He's just back from Europe, where he was meeting with bankers and regulators. And we're talking about Europe on the precipice. And so just walk us through then your idea or what can be done, because first of all, am I correct in suggesting that there's no political will or ability to handle this problem? Nobody seems to want to bite the bullet with Greece and let them default, where they clearly have already probably the barn door's open and the horse is way down the paddock on that one. Two questions, I guess. What can be done, and what do you think will happen?
Well, starting with the first, what we're seeing instead is the old let the twist slowly in the wind. And again, because of Europe's difficulty in making decisions with the ability of a single country to veto anything, mostly what happens is nothing. And so uncertainty is one of the things that markets really hate, and we are maximizing all of this uncertainty. And so the countries of the periphery are getting pummeled. As I say, each of them basically has increasing unemployment, unemployment that is often roughly twice U.S. unemployment. You can imagine what that would do socially within this country to have those levels of unemployment. Well, that's what's happening in Europe. What do they need to do? Well, the euro system inherently does not work. It has a common currency, but not a common nation or common government, and the economies differ enormously. And so, for the reasons I went through, the three options you have to respond to a recession, none of them are available. Instead, you get something that makes it worse. So that is absolutely untenable, and you have to change the euro system. You can keep the currencies that are relatively similar. You could create a euro that had simply France, part of Scandinavia, and Germany and the Netherlands, and that would work probably okay. But the periphery must get out of the euro, and you're going to see no political will to make any decisions. So, again, the twisting slowly in the wind with bailouts, with both groups hating each other. So the periphery feels it's being forced into stupid recessions, and the core feels virtuous and that it's bailing out the lazy, you know, Southerners from the European perspective. You know, they look to Southern Europe and they see people that are their poor relations.
Sure. So given then that the Eurobond suggestion of Soros and others has been rejected by Merkel, given that there's no common European treasury, and you're saying that the only thing that would make sense is for the North to take the euro and cut the South loose, what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, but by the way, I'm thinking that primarily because of what the needs of the South, not the needs of the North. The North feels that it's bailing out the South, but in largest part, it's simply bailing out banks within the North. The bond idea would have worked reasonably well if the European Central Bank was willing to become more like the Fed. As you said, at this juncture, the Germans have blocked that, and that's authentic. That's not just coming from the politicians. If you put it to a vote, I think the idea would have lost about 93% to 7%. So you're not going to get that. You're exposed with this crisis the great myth of the European project. In other words, the way that the French in particular always talked about this as a grand European project of all of us coming together and such. Well, as soon as there was a real problem, it was no longer, well, there are fellow Europeans. It was, those were the damn Greeks, the lazy Greeks who retire at 55 with massive pensions and never pay any taxes. And, of course, there is some truth to these things as well. Greece is very different than Ireland, Portugal, Spain, and Italy. And to date, the crisis, of course, has been focused on Greece,
sure,
but it extends to all of the periphery, and Spain and Italy are massively greater in size of economies
than these nations.
Right, they're too big.
Bailout mechanism.
Right, too big to fail and too big to bail. I'm sorry that we've run out of time, William K. Black, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, as a former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. He is just back from Europe, where he was meeting with bankers and bank regulators. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about deteriorating relations between the United States and Pakistan.
Always had to sling, so let it run. Let it all drop. Let it all drop. Oh, let it all fall off. Let it drop. Let it all drop. Let it all drop. Oh, let it all fall off.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Fair, who formerly was with the was formerly a United Nations political officer. She is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University, and she is also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Oh, hi. Welcome. Thank you for having me.
And tell me about the unusual bluntness of the American ambassador on Pakistani radio, where he blamed the recent incident in Kabul, where a small group of Taliban in an abandoned building held the whole city hostage for a whole day. And he said that these people were with the Haqqani network and that the Pakistani ISI, the military intelligence, was sheltering the Haqqani network. That seemed unusually blunt for a diplomat.
Well, actually, in the last year or so, the U.S. diplomats have really become less diplomatic with Pakistan, and in part because I think the willingness to tolerate very divergent differences between the United States and Pakistan on such important issues as Pakistan's continued support to the Afghan Taliban, the Haqqani network, groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba, and the United States' need to find some way to transition out of Afghanistan, despite all of Pakistan's support to these militant groups operating in Afghanistan elsewhere in the region, has really brought this to a head. And Americans are just really sick of it. You see this in the Congress. There's a lot of debate about whether or not the U.S. should still give Pakistan any kind of financial support because of the ongoing clandestine, although everyone knows about it, support that Pakistan's intelligence agency gives to these groups. So this is, I'm going to say, expect more bluntness.
And tell me what's going on, though, inside of Pakistan with the restrictions on U.S. diplomats, not to mention the intelligence people who since the CIA contract killed a couple of ISI operatives. So there have been a lot of acrimony, surely.
Well, the backstory to this began taking place probably a year and a half or so. I remember when I was getting ready to go out to Lahore for the summer, There were a lot of complaints going on within U.S. officials that were being posted to Pakistan because their visas were taking forever. The visas were taking forever because we, the U.S. government, were making every effort to push a lot of people out there, and to do so in such a way that the United States could actually get more, you know, spooks on the ground, right? And this was becoming apparent as time went on. And it came to a head in particular over the Raymond Davis episode. Raymond Davis was a particular problem because Raymond Davis was a contractor for a CIA cell that were operating unilaterally. That is to say, without the knowledge, cooperation, or what have you, of Pakistan's intelligence agency, the ISI, And by all accounts, they were operating against one of the IFI's assets, Lashkar-e Taiba, among others. And when they came to know about this, according to my sources, the IFI basically paid two goons to go and harass the fellow. And as it turned out, Mr. Davis felt adequately menaced that he actually shot the guy point blank dead. And this became, of course, a diplomatic row. The Director General of the IFI, Pasha, came here, met with George Tenet, and George Tenet just told him outright, you know, this guy wasn't CIA. Now, technically, it was true. He was actually a contractor working for the CIA. He wasn't himself a CIA employee, but this was enough. And what we've seen Pakistan doing, even up to the bin Laden capture kill in May, they were really giving Americans a lot of grief. Visas were being held up. I mean, I'm a university professor, and I've been caught up in this nonsense as well. And the idea is that they know that the U.S. had been putting folks into the mission that were not, you know, diplomats or aid workers, and they wanted to try to curtail that. Then after the bin Laden raid, you know, as you would say, the defecation has hit the rotary oscillator because the Pakistanis are absolutely furious that not only were the Americans operating unilaterally without them, but they were even cultivating Pakistani assets to work on their behalf. So the Pakistanis have really gone at this with all that they have. They've restricted U.S. diplomatic personnel working in Pakistan. So even the ambassador can't go and visit the consulate, for example, in Karachi without having a no objection certificate. Now, the interesting thing is that the U.S. State Department could also get pretty nasty and reciprocate by putting these same kinds of nonsensical restrictions on Pakistani diplomats. So far, that hasn't happened for some reason that I don't quite understand. I thought they would reciprocate.
So the trigger to this then was that the head of the CIA, George Tenet, lied to the head of the ISI, General Pasha?
No, I don't think that was a trigger. I think that there, I mean, it's a more foundational issue.
Mm-hmm.
That the Americans have realized that Pakistan is not at any price denominated in dollars, denominated in F-16s, is not at anything that can be purchased, is going to change its opinion and turn its guns on groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba, go after the Haqqani network and stop supporting the Afghan Taliban. Yet these groups are absolutely injurious to U.S. national interests. And basically, the two countries now understand that they're going to be operating against each other, perhaps more than they might actually be operating with each other on groups where there's mutual interest, such as al-Qaeda. And that's what this is really about, is that in some very real way, what's now very clear and what diplomats are no longer even trying to paper over is that our two countries are on a collision course, that Pakistan's allies are our enemies, and our allies are Pakistan's enemies.
So, but at this moment, I believe there's a gun battle going on between the Pakistan military in South Waziristan and the Taliban over who gets to grab the shot down drone.
Yeah, but the problem, see, I am, at the end of the day, the cynic in me says probably the ISI gave the name Pakistan Taliban to the Pakistani Taliban, because by using that same label, it causes a lot of confusion about who they're killing and who they're supporting. There has been, since around 2002, escalating in particular after 2006, 2007, a number of militant groups who have been very outraged by the Pakistani state for any number of reasons that, you know, we could go on at length about. The Pakistani government has had a historical mixture of policies to deal with them. They will sign peace deals. Rarely do they actually bring peace. Rarely do the deals do anything except bolster the militants and basically bring further problems to the Pakistani government. When militants absolutely refuse to negotiate, and negotiate typically means agree to target the Americans in Afghanistan, not the Pakistanis, then you'll see those militants being killed. So, for example, Naik Mohammed, Baitullah Masood, these were militants that could not be reconciled with the state, that is to say, convinced to kill us in Afghanistan and not Pakistani forces. And when they're shown to be recalcitrant, then they'll be killed. But the the forces that Pakistan is battling is not the Afghan Taliban. The Afghan Taliban are a cluster of militant commanders nominally under the leadership of Mullah Omar that are fighting to overturn the Afghan government supported by the U.S. and NATO. The Pakistan Taliban are much more focused on Pakistan. They tend to not have these grandiose visions. They're not necessarily trying to turn over the state, capital T, capital S. Rather, they're trying to institute these sort of micro emirates of Sharia, where they can sort of do their thing within their own areas of influence. So Pakistan, yes, they are killing and they are being killed by the Pakistan Taliban. But that does not mean that they are not continuing to support, nurture, train, arm, fund the Afghan Taliban and allied commanders like the network of Jalaluddin Haqqani.
So you think now in this there's a new environment where we're going to deal with reality and call it as it is. I mean, on the way out, and it seems that the floods that are happening now again, you know, from the last time there wasn't much of an international response. Now there's 6 million Pakistanis homeless by these latest devastating floods. You get the feeling that not only the United States is getting tired of Pakistan, that the international community is as well.
Yeah, there's just no question. You know, I was really quite saddened by the lack of international response to the floods last year, because some of the places that were most horrifically affected by the floods were places that had previously been afflicted by the Pakistani Taliban. This was the Swat area, of course. And then they were subjected to various bouts of not terribly effective Pakistani army actions that were quite devastating, displaced millions of people. And then finally, the Pakistan army decided that they were going to clear it for real. And by all accounts, they did, albeit with, you know, a lot of human rights violations, we now understand. But then just as the people felt that they could go back into SWAT, the floods came and displaced them again. And so I was quite dismayed last year at why should we support, you know, these terrorism supporters? Well, in point of fact, they had been the victims of terrorism. They had been multiply victimized. But, you know, the money wasn't coming last year. The Chinese have stepped in this time to help with the flood assistance. You know, this is the kind of thing that Pakistanis love to point to their good friend China. In point of fact, China doesn't do nearly as much as Pakistanis like to say they do. China gives mostly assistance in terms of loans, not grant aid. And their aid last year to the floods was absolutely risible. So, I think the international community is just kind of tired of bailing out Pakistan. And then, remember, this takes place in the context of the discussions with the IMF, when Pakistan absolutely refuses to expand its tax net. The poor in Pakistan pay a lot more taxes than the absolute wealthy. I mean, of course, it's a very similar discourse to what's here.
I was about to say that. Sounds like the United States. I'm afraid we have
really
to, on that note, we have to end. And I thank you so much for joining us, Christine Fair.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, who was a United Nations political officer in Kabul. She is a professor at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Jonathan Alter, who's an analyst for NBC News. He has an article at Bloomberg View called America's Lost Decade. And I tried to talk to him a lot about the extent to which the article really got my attention, because it points out that there'd never been a more disastrous decade than the decade of George W. Bush. Going back probably in America's history, the country continued to grow even with setbacks. And if you compare it to the decade that we were comparing this 9/11 10th anniversary to, which was the Pearl Harbor attack is often compared to 9/11, from 1941 to 1951, the country made enormous advances. So will the American people recognize this? He really went on a tear about progressives and how they are abandoning Obama, and they have no concept of how dangerous somebody like a President Perry would be. And I said, well, you know, that's always the way that the Democrats argue. Well, if you don't vote for us, you know, the Supreme Court will go to hell. Well, he agrees that they should have a narrative, but he also feels that people really have got to have some proportionality in recognizing the dangers here. Then we spoke with William Black, who investigated the savings and loan disaster of the 1980s. He's just back from Germany, where he met with a bunch of bankers and bank regulators. And he thinks, in many ways, that the it's propping up the euro that's causing the problems, as opposed to cutting bait. And it was a very interesting discussion. The German people are furious, and they don't want to bail out Greece. But what they don't recognize is they're actually bailing out German banks. And he said that's the real irony that's going on here, that people don't recognize, and least of all the Germans. And the whole situation is just adrift. I guess that's the best way to put it. Then I spoke with Christine Fair, who worked for she's a UN political officer in Kabul, one of the best specialists on Pakistan. She was saying that the Pakistani U.S. ambassador to Pakistan is really taking the gloves off, that the Pakistanis wouldn't even let the U.S. ambassador visit a hospital that the U.S. had paid for in another city. That gives you an idea of the pettiness of the restrictions. The ISI is at war with the CIA. She traces that back to when George Tenet lied to the head of the ISI, General Pasha, over the CIA contractor who turned out he shot two ISI operatives who were either going to kidnap him or rough him up or whatever. She said situation there is really bad. That is the, I guess we've had that conversation before, and it seems to be going from bad to worse. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Disappeared by half.